Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, sponsored by the audiobook edition of Will Eisner, A Spirited Life, now available on iTunes and Audible.com, and recorded live on BlogTalkRadio.com from the new media and American League Baseball capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I met cartoonist Howard Cruz in March 2004. It's true, because I looked it up, at the Ringling School of Art and Design in Sarasota, Florida. He was one of the featured guests at the college's Comic Summit on Diversity, an event that included Mary Grand Prix, who was the illustrator of the Harry Potter novels, and American master cartoonist and writer Will Eisner, whose biography I was just finishing at the time. Howard and I had corresponded a few times before then via email, as part of my research. And to be honest, I only knew him as a cartoonist then. I don't recall connecting that he was attending this event as a gay cartoonist. And even if it did, it wouldn't have mattered. But I knew that Eisner held him in high esteem, as did the teaching staff at the school, and that was good enough for me. Now, since then, I've learned more about what an important role Howard played over the years as both a cartoonist with a strong social voice and as a gay advocate. He illustrated his own coming out over the years in his comics and no doubt gave other young men strength in their own decisions to take pride in their identities as well. And Howard's work has been everywhere from Playboy and Starlog magazines to The Advocate. He was the founding editor of Gay Comics, started by our mutual friend, Dennis Kitchen. And his groundbreaking graphic novel, Stuck Rubber Baby, I can never say that with a straight face, pardon the pun, but I just can't. It won numerous awards, including an Eisner and a Harvey. Now, the occasion of our conversation today is the publication of his latest book, From Head Rack to Claude, Collected Gay Comics by Howard Cruz. Howard, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. How you been?
Doing fine.
Yeah. How's married life treating you?
Well, Eddie and I have been together for 30 years now. We have been officially married now that we're Massachusetts residents. We've been married for around 5 years now. But we're pretty used to each other by now, and I don't think we would have made it 30 years if we didn't find it comfortable to live together.
I got to ask, is it different? I mean, lots of couples, straight or gay, find things change when you get married. Any change for you guys?
No, not really.
Really?
We were linked pretty solidly all the way through, and we probably wouldn't have gotten married if there wasn't a political dimension to it, in that and just the excitement of being part of history, because at the time, of course, it was a huge step for Massachusetts to be the only state where gay marriage had legal standing, and so it was nice to be part of that first rush, and also it was nice to stick a thumb in George Bush's eye. And actually, it becomes a more practical issue as you get older, because there are many benefits that affect, you know, the welfare in serious ways of people who, differently if they're married or single. Of course, as far as we, the federal government is concerned, we're not married. So this has made it impossible to use tax software to fill out our tax forms because...
Interesting point, yeah.
Yeah, the TurboTax rebels if you list yourself as married on the state form but single on the federal form. It just says, does not compute, you know, go back and change one or the other. So we've had to use an accountant since we got married. But it really is quite serious. If we were to get ill or particularly need to to have our Social Security benefits interact because of illness or age or whatever, we would still be disadvantaged compared to straight people because the federal government says we're not married, and that could affect whether we would have to sell our house if one of us had to go to a nursing home or something like that. There's somebody, you know, the gay organizations have made a list and found there are about 1,000 benefits that are denied gay couples and even gay married couples that are taken for granted by straight couples, and this is why it's patently unequal protection of the laws federally. But of course, the only way that, you know, you get past that is you have to have Supreme Courts that are willing to take a stand that for many people would be unpopular. So who knows if things reach the current Supreme Court, how it would go.
Are things, this is a fitting conversation considering where we're going with this, and I won't stay on it, but I won't stay on it too long, but are you in better shape as a married couple, even with limitations, than you would have been as a couple without marriage?
Well, yes, because there are also state benefits that are affected. And Massachusetts is, has a number of benefits that, it makes sense for people to be married. It just has to do with the way people, their assets relate, the automatic passing on of assets if one person dies to the other without having to have, extra contracts and things like that. Anything that's a state benefit, we now have the standing that any married couple would have. But if we, these days there's been an expansion of the rights to other states. I used to say if we step across the Massachusetts line, all of a sudden we're single. Now, we stay married in most of New England and even in New York, where people, residents of New York who are gay can't get married, but they do recognize marriages from out of state. It's just an example of the craziness of all of this, and it would be so much simpler if they were just national gay marriage and forget about it. Because if you look at the way things have gone in Massachusetts, nobody's life is affected negatively by the fact that gay marriage is legal.
Only the people who are hung up on it.
Well, I mean, they have their own psychological problems, but there are people who are hung up on everything from whether the world is flat or not, So you can't...
What?
You can't run the world based on whether somebody's going to be upset.
Yeah. Now, I got to say, and I'll let this go in a second, but I got to say to you that one of the first things you just said to me when we started out was that nothing has really changed since you've been married. And I got to tell you that on behalf of straight couples around the world, that if nothing changed when you guys got married, you must be doing it wrong. That's all I'm saying. I'm sure I can get a quorum of people immediately to put their hand up and say, hallelujah.
Well, that reminds me of the old Woody Allen joke about, is sex dirty? It is if you're doing it right.
Yeah, exactly. And before we go any further, I want to say, if you've got a comment or question for cartoonist Howard Cruz, whose new book is From Head Rack to Claude, Collected Gay Comics, give us a call, 1-646-595-3135. Call into the switchboard. I'll get you on as quickly as I can. Your comments are welcome. I didn't warn Howard that he might have to take a call, but feel free. We'll put
fine.
Him on the spot.
That's fine.
So let's turn to the comics. That's why we're here. What is it like to hold these collected works? Now, it's not everything, but, a survey of your career in your hand. I mean, personally, I don't think it'll ever happen to me, but I'd feel kind of a mix of pride and advancing age if it was me.
Well, that's true. And also, if you have work that covers 33 years, which is the time span covered by the comics in this book, you're very aware of all the lessons you've learned along the way and things you would have done differently. You sort of imagine if you had been your own student in those days, you could say, well, now this is not a good idea. One thing you're very aware of is that the hazards of topical references that seem very current when you're doing them, but then 15 years later, they're likely to make people feel puzzled. And so I oftentimes there will be maybe one panel or something that I'll say, gee, if I'd phrased that a little differently, it would have lasted better over time. But that's the nature of art. You know, you recognize places where you didn't draw something as well as it could be drawn, and that's part of the learning.
Any particularly cringeworthy content as you went back to gather this together?
No, I mean, most of the work in this book was done after I had begun to get a reasonable handle on things. Now, in terms of the topicality, I could point to things. For example, there's a reference in a strip called The Gay in the Street, which is a mock interview of me by a television crew asking about the future of gays. And this was drawn in 1984. And at the time, there was this sculptor whose name was George Siegel, who got famous for making sculptures by wrapping actual people in plaster and making a plaster cast of entire people, you know, with their clothes on and everyday people. And so he was very hot in the art world at the time. And I sort of ended the story with a joke about, you know, me being wrapped and made into a statue. And, you know, then these many years later, I mean, he died, I think, in the 90s or something. And meanwhile, there's an actor named George Siegel who's been in a lot of things. And so I realized that the final caption of the picture, as I'm there turned into a statue with a pigeon on my shoulder, and the caption is George Siegel strikes again, this would like draw a complete blank for people that weren't aware of what was happening in art in the 80s. And so this book has a number of explanatory places to give people an idea of what in the world I was talking about in this point at that point.
Well, I like that, actually, for a lot of reasons. I figured, I'm not gay, and I figured, well, maybe that'll help me through some of this, because I saw that in the introduction, and so I thought, okay, well, maybe there'll be some references that Howard is going to help me understand. And then I just like the idea that you're not abandoning us at the beginning of the book and saying, okay, go read whatever opinions you form, but you're there. I mean, you're there throughout the book, and you're kind of like a miniature Greek course in some ways.
Well, one thing I'm very aware of is most of these comics that are in this book were drawn on the assumption that the main readership would be gay. They were, actually, that's not true so much of the political strips I did for The Village Voice, but mm-hmm. the strips that I did for gay comics, the main audience for gay comics originally was other gay people. And you don't need to explain the particularities of gay subculture to other gay people. So there are some things that are taken for granted that for a person who had never been part of the gay subculture, conceivably they could be taken aback, like the sort of public sex scene that was popular in the late 70s prior to the arrival of the AIDS epidemic, when there seemed to be no downside to basically the old, if it feels good, do it, attitude. And so anyway, there's a story called Billy Goes Out, which kind of shows that gay cruising scene from that period. And you can't help being conscious with the perspective of history that there was danger lurking in the form of a virus, or a retrovirus to be exact.
Right.
And so later on, a strip that I did several years later called Safe Sex includes a panel, includes two panels that refer back to the Billy Goes Out story, in which, in essence, it identifies, a character says, Billy's dead. You know, the character who, in all innocence, was just trying to find himself and enjoy himself in that world of gay sex, was the kind of person that was caught unawares and quite possibly wouldn't have survived the epidemic. I mean, it's only by good fortune that I survived, and many of my friends didn't, and they were not, you know, in any way lurid or unadmirable people, but because of the time lag between the time of getting infected and the time of getting sick, essentially a lot of people were blindsided when they were just doing what they thought was safe, and it turned out not to be.
And, you know, I think in fairness, and it's worth pointing out that while that was happening on the gay side of things in the early 80s or late 70s, the same kind of scene existed on the straight side. I mean, there were, you know, most famously Plato's Retreat on the straight side, but right. there were all kinds of stuff going on. It wasn't just that general attitude wasn't strictly, you know.
Right, and it was all part of the sexual revolution that is the emblem of which was Playboy magazine. And it's a sexual revolution, you know, is not something that I back away from. I think it was a good thing psychologically. And, you know, we have learned that you can't be totally blasé about, you know, issues of viruses and possible contagion and things like that. Most of us have had to learn to factor in such things. But the freedom to simply express yourself sexually, both recreationally and, you know, in affectionate relationships, I mean, that's very important, and that was allowed to become much freer of guilt during the 70s and thereafter. One thing I objected to very much was the attempt by some people to put this overlay of guilt on people who became sick with AIDS and refer to people who got AIDS, came down with AIDS because of other forms of transmission, such as, you know, getting blood transfusions in hospitals or something, as they're the innocent victims, with the implication that the gay people who died were not innocent. And I reject that. And I think that I would think it was good for straight people and good for gay people to loosen up. But, you know, the big fallacy was that to enjoy sex recreationally does not mean to be incapable of also having affectionate relationships, as my relationship with Eddie is an example. And many people who, you know, played around with things like Plato's Retreat, I'm sure it was something they did for fun on a Saturday night, but meanwhile they had their life. And one mm-hmm. of my goals in the Billy Goes Out story was I had this duality of what was physically happening to Billy on this night when he goes out cruising and what was in his mind, which manifested all of the other sides of his life that were much more, you know, everyday and showed he was not just some person who lived for sex.
Now, there certainly were those people, though.
Well, I mean, you know, there are people who go to excess in all
right.
in all areas. Anything that is capable of being done excessively, you will find people who do them excessively. And that's it's like to take a sip of alcohol is not to become an alcoholic, but alcoholism is real. And people who become, you know, become incapable of thinking of sex in any way other than just I want to have couple with as many people as possible throughout my life, are missing out, you know, and they're missing out on something that they may not even be aware they're missing out on because they are allowing themselves to be obsessive. So they need therapy.
Have your views on things like this, have they evolved over the years? I mean, as you mentioned, you've been in the same relationship for 30 years. Do you think mm-hmm. your views on subjects like this have changed maybe more than someone who has not been in a steady relationship for three decades?
Well, I would just, you know, I would have to be anecdotal about the people I happen to know. And mm-hmm. I would say that most people understood quite a ways back that, you know, that there are different sides of life and that recreational sex is one side of life, but there's lots of other important sides of life, and you know that is true whether you're in a relationship or not. And you know, in that sense, I don't think, you know, I think the only thing that's changed is my awareness that you can't just behave as if there's no such issue as health to be watched out for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me change gears a little bit. Now, you mentioned Playboy a little while ago as kind of the standard bearer for mm-hmm. the sexual revolution. And I was a little surprised, only in retrospect, to learn that you once did cartoons for Playboy. How did it come about that you worked for Playboy, and why did it fall apart so quickly? Did it have to do with your... Go ahead.
Well, you would have to go inside the minds of the cartoon editor to know what the relationship was between my coming out professionally and the sort of loss of interest in having be a Playboy regular. Playboy, one of the things that's to be admired about Playboy, I mean, there's plenty to be criticized as a certain kind of juvenile attitude toward sex and women that, it's a little embarrassing in light of the feminist revolution and all of that. On the other hand, Playboy has been a big supporter of feminism in most areas and has been a supporter of sexual liberation, including gay liberation, along the way. And they have, I mean, as far back as when I was in college, they were publishing articles by, Open the Gay People, and they did interviews with Tennessee Williams and Truman Capote that were up front, and there was no sense that they were interviewing dissolute people. So I don't think the magazine itself had a homophobic cast. Sometimes they would indulge in kind of innuendo humor where the joke is that somebody is gay. And I would kind of cringe at that. But in general, I would give Playboy good marks for not being among the homophobic institutions of the world and for making a lot of people feel better about sex and more guilt-free about sex. But I got into it specifically. I would not have ever thought I had any entree at Playboy, but because of my work I had done in underground comic books, Skip Williamson, who another great underground comics artist, he had often worked with Playboy. I don't actually know in what capacity specifically, but anyway, he was enlisted to get underground cartoonists to participate in this section of the magazine called Playboy Funnies, which was specifically comic strips as opposed to the gag cartoons that they had always been famous for. And so he called up various people, including me and Prina Robbins and Art Spiegelman, and there were others. And so they had this 3 or 4 pages of comic strips in the magazine for a while. And so Skip Williamson suggested that I go talk to the cartoon editor and bring some of my work. And as it happened, I had quite recently done a parody of Little Lulu, my favorite comic strip from my youth. And it was that was among the things that I showed Michelle Urey, who was the cartoon editor. And she really brightened up because she saw that I could mimic other cartoonists' styles. And she said, why don't I try doing some parodies of existing newspaper strips for the magazine? And so I brought in samples, and they, accepted a bunch of them. Unfortunately, I couldn't get them to... I also would have liked for them to publish comic strips that were done in my native style, but... I gather that Hugh Hefner, everything had to go through Hugh Hefner. Now, I never met the man, but everything we did that we submitted was sent to him for approval and for comment. And I gather that he didn't care for my native drawing style because I could never get them to print anything that was not a parody. But I did do a number of parodies and had fun with them. But then they started getting complaints from the syndicates about it. And... this happened to be around the time that the case of the lawsuit between Walt Disney and the Air Pirates came to a head. And Air Pirates, for those who don't know, and most people wouldn't unless they were alive then, were a band of underground cartoonists who took the attitude, a sort of a subversive attitude, that they had some kind of human right to appropriate Disney characters on the basis that the Disney characters had become cultural icons and do terrible things with them and have them, Mickey and Minnie, having sex and lots of untoward things. And Disney at the time was still in the grip of a kind of relatively Puritan attitude that fortunately they have moved away from then. And they had no sense of humor about this, and so they sued this ragtag bunch of underground cartoonists who didn't have, you know, could in no way effectively go up against Disney for copyright infringement. And this course was, this case was in the courts for a number of years, and in, I think it was either 1978 or 79, somewhere in there, around the time that I had begun working with Playboy, the California Ninth Circuit did a ruling which essentially pulled the teeth out of parody as a comic book medium. They basically imposed an unworkable rule which said that if you were doing parody, which they said you still have a right to do under the fair use rules of the exception of the copyright law, you could not make what you were doing look exactly like what you were parodying. It could only be as much like it as was necessary to conjure up what you were parodying. Now, that is an extremely gray area that no one could know when what is just enough and no more to conjure up. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm doing a parody of Mickey Mouse, you know, exactly how close can I make it to Mickey Mouse before it is closer to it than is necessary to conjure up Mickey Mouse. So it was essentially, it made it hazardous to do comic strip parodies unless you really took made them look very different from the originals. And Playboy got nervous and abandoned these parodies of mine then. And since he didn't like my drawings that weren't parodies, I sort of ceased being a Playboy regular. But I also felt I got a little bit of a cold shoulder from the art director after I came out.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. I got the sense in the introduction that maybe you felt that had something to do with it. And
well, let me put it this way. When I first made contact with her and she looked at my portfolio, she was very enthusiastic and said, "We've got to get you in Playboy." And I felt extremely welcome and valued there for a while. And then after I announced that we were going to do gay comics, and I ran into her at a social, you know, at a professional social occasion, she was suddenly very distant. So, you know, one can interpret that how one will. As I say, I'm not inside her head, and I don't know what was going on. But it was a very big contrast, and it made me feel that perhaps she had some issues about that. But I don't, you know, I can't say that for sure.
And do you think when you, and I guess your professional coming out was when you did take over gay comics, which was
There's sort of stages. It's like coming out in the world in other ways. Usually there are stages. Maybe a rare person does everything at once, but usually there are first your close friends that you tell, and maybe then a few teachers, but you're still keeping it a secret from other people. And then comes the point where all of your friends know, and then everyone in your world knows. And I was sort of in the stage of everyone in my personal life knew, but meanwhile I was publishing underground comics, and I was worried about sacrificing my cartooning career. Mm-hmm. And yet I wanted, I recognized the need for getting rid of the secrecy about this. So I was resolved as early as like 1973 that, you know, in my future was going to be totally out in my work. Mm-hmm. But that came in stages. First, in 1976, I did the first story in the book called Gravy on Gay, which features the character Hidrak, who had been part of my Barefoot series all along, but this was the story in which it, you know, developed that he was gay. But it didn't actually say Howard Cruise was gay.
Right.
And then came the announcement about 3 years later that I was going to do gay comics, that I was going to be the editor of gay comics, and that essentially told the world of underground comics readers and other artists that I was gay. But then after we launched gay comics, I was invited by the Village Voice to do another strip that's in the book called Sometimes I Get So Mad. And the publication of that was basically the thing that put it out there for anyone who happens to walk down the street and pick up a Village Voice.
Right.
So after that, there were no further groups that didn't know I was gay. And that was a big relief because it uses up energy trying to keep secrets, and it also prevents you from taking your making your art as authentic as it needs to be good art.
Now, Howard, I want to come back to this in a minute, but we've got a call. Let's see what they've got to say. Hi, do you have a comment or question for Howard Cruz? You're on the air. Hello? Going once, twice. All right.
They're gone.
Well, yeah. So much for that. They've been hanging on there a long time. Along that line, what I wondered is, by coming out the way you did professionally, personally, different thing. Do you paint yourself into a bit of a corner, or as Will Eisner used to say about comic book artists, that they were in a ghetto that was below pornographers. But I mean, was there enough work outside of being the editor of Gay Comics to work in gay-only publications? Did you put yourself in that position?
No, I was very specifically, one of the reasons I hesitated as long as I did to come out and sort of planned it out as much was because it was very important to me to be established first as a cartoonist in general, both in underground comics and, to begin to make inroads into, mainstream illustration and stuff like that. Because, I'm a whole person. I'm not a person who lives and breathes gayness. That just happens to be one facet of my life. And I have things to say about other topics. And also, I needed work. You didn't make a living in underground comics. It paid very little. So I needed to have freelance illustration work or get other opportunities to do comics on other topics if I was going to make a living. And so I was holding my breath when that Village Voice article came back because I knew it would be seen by various clients who were using my work that had nothing to do with gay. I mean, I was doing regular illustrations for American Health magazine and for American Photography magazine. I was still doing drawings for Starlog, which I had been art director of briefly, but I was still freelancing for them. And there were several other magazines and art directors who would use me regularly, and I didn't know if this would be effective. Oh, and then I got this great opportunity to do stuff for Bananas magazine, which was sort of a Scholastic magazine's answer to Mad. It's kind of a mixture between Mad and Tiger Beat. They had articles about teen faves mixed in with comics and satires. And the editor of Bananas magazine, who has gone on to fame as R.L. Stein, who created the Goosebumps series, but he was editing Bananas magazine then, one of the sweetest guys that anybody ever worked with. And he totally was unfazed, and he used me without regard to anything that was going on with gay comics elsewhere. I was a regular. I did a strip called Dr. Duck for Bananas magazine for a year or so, and did lots of other illustrations for their little satirical articles. So, I was relieved that it did not. The people didn't lose their willingness to use me in places and for things that were unrelated to being gay. That was very important to me because, to some extent, I was aware that that other young gay cartoonists would be watching what happened to me and making decisions about whether it was safe to be out based on whether it killed my career to do that. So besides worrying about my own welfare, I also worried about the symbolism of just suddenly becoming the gay cartoonist and nothing else. So I was working hard at avoiding that. But, because it was so unusual, I think to a lot of people that's the first thing they think of, oh, he's the gay cartoonist.
Well, I wonder, when you literally come out, it's one thing when you're just working and people gradually get to know that this is who you are. But when you announce that you're the editor of Gay Comics, it would probably send a signal to people who either are going to care or not. Now, the next thing I wanted to ask you about is, I mean, young gay artists today, they have a number of role models now, that such as yourself, to emulate or from whom to seek inspiration. But who did you look to as a young man not ready to announce your sexual preference?
I didn't have any role models as far as cartoonists were concerned.
Yeah.
The only gay cartoonists and I'm talking about gay male cartoonists because I did have some role models on the lesbian side. People like Roberta Gregory and Mary Wings had begun publishing underground comics about their experiences, and that gave me heart. But although there were earlier gay male underground comic books, they tended to be focused on campiness and silliness and stereotypes and stuff, and that was not what I was interested in. So I really didn't have role models. What I had as role models were people in the literary world, people like Allen Ginsberg and Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams, who reassured me that you could be out in the world and be, you know, involved with other people and not be shunned if everyone around you knew that you were gay. And I realized that today's to people who grew up, particularly in the in the last 20 or 30 years, that might seem really strange, but there was almost a witch-burning attitude toward gays for many years, and certainly when I was young. To some extent, I reflect that period in my story, Jerry Mack, in the book, which is about a tortured, closeted minister and his, how he is driven out of town, which was based on an experience with someone I knew. And that was, matter of fact, the first person that I ever knew was homosexual, was beaten up and run out of town. And so that sort of let me know the hazards involved in that and made me try very hard not to be gay and for a long time. So that was the world that I grew up in. And, you know, the idea of people just being out and not caring what people thought and being accepted by the other people, that was hard to fathom. I remember one time I was in summer camp. I was a counselor in summer camp. And this rumor started going around that one of the campers' queer uncles had come to visit. And, you know, everyone was all abuzz, and that was very shocking. And I remember at the time, my understanding was, oh, to be gay it means that you will be arrested. And so how is it that this person is just sort of being allowed to walk around the camp instead of being hauled off to jail immediately? I mean, I was, you know, like a preteen or teen at the time, and it took a while to grasp that the world wasn't totally stacked that severely against every gay person. But the trouble is that there are many situations where someone like that would have been arrested for no reason. So all it takes is knowing that there's a danger to make everybody feel, you know, to have a chilling effect, as the phrase goes, even if you're not being actively censored. If you know you can be censored, you're likely to censor yourself.
Hmm. Is that situation better today? I mean, if you were starting today, you think you'd be you'd be able to think and act more in a mainstream fashion?
Oh, yeah, all you have
fashion?
To do is look around at all the kids. Kids are coming out. Excuse me. I have a sneeze. There we go. You see kids coming out earlier and earlier and feeling safe, but the difference is I knew nobody when I was a kid, nobody else. I felt completely alone and completely vulnerable. Today, there are enough kids who identify themselves as gay early, and, you know, they band together and they're friends and they have a circle of friends and they reinforce each other's sense of self-worth. You still have situations like the Matthew Shepard situation or other gay bashing situations and tragedies and things like that Israel thing that happened in Israel last week with someone shooting in a gay bar. But those tend to be much rarer. These days, the form that homophobia tends to take is less brutal, but is still about making it impossible for people to lead regular lives. They can be fired, you know, in many places you can be fired from your job for no reason other than that somebody discovers you're gay, or you can, I mean, when I was a kid, I had thought maybe I would be a teacher, but it was simply, once I realized I was gay, that was ruled out. I knew there would be no such thing as allowing someone to be a teacher. And yet now there's, you know, the Gay Teachers Association.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems like all the female gym teachers I knew, I would guess that several of them were gay, and I don't think anyone...
Well, that's one of the fields that, like being in theater, there are a number of fields that, although not everybody is gay, they're known for not being hostile to gays, and therefore people who have those talents will gravitate toward those fields.
Interesting. And you teachers know who you are. I'm not pointing any fingers. and everyone I went to high school with, you know exactly who I'm talking about. So,
well, there's a lesbian singer songwriter named Meg Christian, who did a song called "The Gym Teacher." You know, that was a nostalgic song about the lesbian who was an important role model for her. And you know, so it's not imaginary that. Yeah, but, you know, they're also your gay garbage collector and your gay, you know, everything. It's just that some fields are more, you know, agreeable if that's your orientation.
No, well, sometimes there's a reason why people call them stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you were there at the beginning of gay comics. Now, I have to ask, because the way society is changing slowly but surely, has anyone produced gay marriage comics yet?
Well, I mean, to the extent that there are venues that publish gay comics, I'm sure that the topic of gay marriage is likely to crop up. I don't think you could put together a whole publication about it because, like I say, it's too normal. It's too everyday. The experiences are relatively indistinguishable from straight experiences in a lot of ways, so I'm not sure there's that topic in itself, other than the political dimension of, you know, trying to combat the politicians and pressure groups who are against it. You know, you could get some mileage out of that, but the actual marriage itself is just too normal to get a whole bunch of comics about.
All right. Well, last question before we wrap it up, and I want to give everybody information about how to order your book and all the other goodies mm-hmm. that are available. What do you do next? You've just published this collection of gay comics across your career from start to most recent. What do you have in mind next? What are you going to work on?
Well, I'm actually sort of entering a new phase of my life now because I've gotten old enough to get Social Security, and that gets a little income coming in that you don't have to spend time working for. And I've just quit teaching. I've been teaching at a local college here in Massachusetts, but I've quit that because I'm trying to sort of simplify my life so I can do more art, and some of which may take the form of comics. I expect it will, but there are other things I'm interested in. I used to do a lot of playwriting. I might do some more of that. And, you know, there's a lot of back burner projects. It's too early right now to say what I'm going to concentrate on now, so I'm sort of sifting through things that I've wanted to do for a long time that I've been prevented from doing because of the necessity of getting freelance work or preparing classes and all the other things that take up life. So now I feel I'm a little freer from that stuff, and I'm not sure myself what comes next. But I do know that, you know, I'm really enjoying the possibility of being creative without having to stop constantly to go teach a class.
I understand. Well, folks, I want to tell you, I'm sorry I didn't mention this sooner, but you can order Howard Cruz's new book, From Head Rack to Claude, Collected Gay Comics, by visiting his website, www.howardcruz.com. It's Howard, C-R-U-S-E,
.com. None of that Cruz with an I in it.
Right. None of that Cruz missile stuff. This is Howard Cruz.
Right.
And so you can order the book there, and then his other books, there's links there, as well as I put a link up in our web chat to some of the goodies that you've got available for sale on Cafe Press as well, mm-hmm. cups and all kinds of stuff.
Well, thank you very much. Nice of you.
Howard, you know, we've been in contact for the last 5 or 6 years now. We got to meet. It's been a pleasure to get to know you. I hope the book does real well, and thanks so much for being on the show today.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate being invited, Bob.
My pleasure. Good luck to you, and let's stay in touch.
Same here.
All right. Bye-bye. And folks, for more interviews with your favorite comic book and comic strip artists and writers, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with Patrick McDonnell, Ray Billingsley, Jerry Scott, Rick Kirkman, Jim Borgman, John Rosenberg, Stefan Pastis, Mark Tatulli, Mort Walker, Dennis Kitchen, Drew Friedman, Dave Gibbons, Joe Sinnott, Mark Chiarello, Gene Colan, and many more. And please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites. Whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, TrueSlant, Digital Journal, Vox, Podcast Pickle, MediaFly, Blueberry, Zencast, Zimbio, or Odeo. And subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. Or subscribe to Mr. Media's blog on the Amazon Kindle Reader. You can also listen with a piece of string in a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate when you give up a little piece of your day to spend it with us. Thanks for listening, everybody.